Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a two-part series that is titled David Ferry, Barry Seal, and the JFK Assassination. And it kind of came to mind as I was researching today and came across this old kind of picture. Somebody actually said to me on YouTube that Barry Seal, who was a famed transporter of cocaine, right, for the Medellin cartel, MENA, was in the Civil Air Patrol. And if you're watching this on YouTube or Rockfin or Twitter, I have this kind of infamous picture that cropped up after the JFK assassination of David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald in the cap. And this was taken in 1955. And right around the time that Barry Seal was supposed to be in there as a very young, like 16-year-old being trained. And I have to give a research credit out to at Kyoto, the guys from my Twitter feed, but he kind of got some pictures and put them together, and it's COYOTL 2021, and I'll put a link to his research, but you can see this is somebody who looks like Barry Seal right next to Lee Harvey Oswald. I don't know if anybody's ever pointed that out, but this picture is kind of infamous because it places Oswald and Ferry together. But yeah, Barry Seal, very interesting. There's a better picture. This is the original. This is it touched up. And he really does kind of look like a young Barry Seal. If you see kind of, I'll show pictures of it right here. This is Barry, and we'll look at, this is based upon research done by Daniel Hopsicker. The book is Barry and the Boys, the CIA, the Mob, and America's Secret History, about Barry Seal. And you'll see this picture on the cover of Hopsicker with Barry Seal staring right at the camera and smiling. But this is from a website of Daniel Hopsicker, and it reads, the subtitle reads, 16-year-old Baton Rouge Civil Air Patrol cadet Barry Seal boards a U.S. Air Force plane on July 23, 1955 to fly to a two-week training camp at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, where he will meet fellow cadet Lee Harvey Oswald from New Orleans. And both will fall under the sway of CIA agent and pedophile Captain David Ferry. So people have been listening to my show. I've been doing this show on David Ferry. And I titled it, Who is David Ferry? And then I go to find out that Barry and the Boys and Hopsicker wrote a chapter called Who is David Ferry? So he was kind of under the same sense of curiosity about this interesting character. But these are kind of the young pictures of a Barry Seal who learned to fly at 16 and was a talented pilot by a very young age, much like David Ferry, who became a very talented pilot. But he, Barry Seal, as he grew older, a little more corpulent. But if you look at these side-by-side pictures, there is a likelihood that that is a very young Barry Seal, I think so. So I'm going to reference two books. I mentioned Barry and the Boys, but I will also reference Smugglers and the Life and Death of Barry Seal. I also have an article called Who Killed Barry Seal? But you'll see this Barry and the Boys. And if you kind of look at the cover of that on the left, it's third from the left is Barry Seal smiling at the camera. Very young. I think he's 22 or 23 at that time. And he's right next to Porter Goss, who was in the Bush administration. I forgot what his role, but yeah, he was in that. So I'm going to also pull up the website so you can see kind of some of the work. I mean, Hopsicker was a real journalist, authentic investigative journalist. I'd never read through Barry and the Boys. I might have glanced through it, but it seems like it's a mistake in retrospect, that's for sure. But this is from September 13, 2017, Barry Seal, an American-made cigar store Indian's Daniel Hopsicker. And it's based upon this movie that came out with Tom Cruise, where he plays basically Barry Seal. It's an $80 million love letter to Tom Cruise's sunglasses. Turning Barry Seal, one of America's most important covert operatives of the 20th century, into a cigar store Indian. It is interesting. These guys, these covert operatives, Ferry and Seal, were really remarkable. And from the Daily Variety, it reads, Seal, a devil-may-care playboy in a TWA uniform, is keeping himself amused with the odd bit of cigar smuggling and faked in-flight turbulence when he's approached by a CIA man to fly undercover for them, skimming Central America to take surveillance photos. And then a Hollywood reporter back in the 70s when you could still smoke in the cockpit and cocktail waitresses would blank anything in uniform. Seal was a pilot for TWA with a nice little smuggling business on the side, bringing Cuban cigars into the U.S. from Canada and Mexico. So he had an official job, just like David Ferry, which is remarkable. And so you'll see, this is the picture that I showed earlier. It's from this website. And I didn't know this Barry Seal was like Ferry. He was involved in the Bay of Pigs. This is from Hopsicker. Barry Seal flew guns into the mountains of Cuba to Fidel Castro while the CIA still supported him in 1958 at the tender age of 17. 3 years later, Barry Seal flew at the Bay of Pigs invasion. And this postcard's from the edge. This is also Hopsicker. On March 29, 1961, 2 days before the Bay of Pigs invasion, 22-year-old Barry Seal wrote home from Guatemala, quote, "I'm probably going to stay at this picture of the volcano overlooking Lake Atitlan a couple of days," unquote. And this is the same picture that Hopsicker used for the cover of Barry and the Boys. And Barry Seal was a member of the super secret CIA assassination squad known as Operation 40. And this was taken January 22nd, 1963, Mexico City. The only extant photo of CIA assassination squad Operation 40, Barry Seal, third from left, Porter Gossa sitting on Barry's right with his hand on Felix Rodriguez, front left. William Houston Seymour, front right. To Seymour's left, hiding his face, is Frank Sturgis. And then Hopsicker writes, Frank Sturgis, a member of the team that broke into Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate complex in 1972, later admitted to have been part of Operation 40. So was Barry Seal. Yeah, Barry was Op 40, Gerald Hemming confirmed to us. He flew in killer teams inside the island Cuba before the invasion to take out Fidel. Barry Seal flew into the Golden Triangle during America's secret war in Laos. There is strong but less than conclusive evidence that Barry Seal flew a getaway plane out of Redbeard Airfield in Dallas after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And that's the argument they make about Ferry, why he went to Houston on the day of the assassination, is to fly people out into Mexico. And all this before Barry Seal became famous for importing tons of cocaine, at least $5 billion worth through MENA in the 1980s. In other words, Barry Seal didn't just get lucky. MENA was no accident. So I think he was very critical. Hopsicker was very critical of the American-made film. And Barry Seal died kind of a death. He was in a courtroom. He had a court case, and then the judge sentenced him to community service at a thrift store or something like that. And then he got shot. Yeah, it was a Salvation Army Center. So he was killed on February 19th, 1986. So all these guys met kind of a bloody end. Ferry, Oswald, and Seal. Seal was hit 6 times, died almost instantly. 6 Colombians were quickly arrested in connection with the murder. 3 of them were indicted on state charges of capital murder. So then there was a trial. And looks like they all went to jail. Life in jail without parole. So, yeah, Seal, there's a whole story. And this book is like 400 pages. The book that that Hopsicker wrote. And Hopsicker passed away just last year, August 22nd, 2023. So you see a picture of him here. I don't think that was his only book. I feel like he wrote something else. Terrorland, yeah, about Muhammad Atta. And then Gangster Planet, I guess he was working on. But, so here's his book. And I'm going to read from the chapter, Who is David Ferry? And then chapter 15, Did Barry Seal Fly a Getaway Plane Out of Dallas? I was going to do a Nagel show today, actually. But this just popped up. So I might bounce around as well because of... some of the stuff overlaps, but he did talk to people who were originally knew Ferry. Like he has direct quotes that are not included in the HSCA material or some of the other material, the Garrison material as well. So this is from Ferry and the Boys. This isn't David Ferry, but he says, I laughed when I saw him, but Barry told me to stay by the plane or he wouldn't let me fly back to Baton Rouge. He was drilling a bunch of CAP, Civil Air Patrol cadets, all carrying the old M1 rifles, standing in formation in front of him. His name was David Ferry. He was a captain in the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol. Even if you're not a JFK assassination researcher, and we weren't, it is no secret that David Ferry, played by Joe Pesci in Oliver Stone's movie JFK, is on researchers' top 10 list of people in on the hit. He was, in fact, under suspicion of involvement in the assassination less than 48 hours after Kennedy died. John Odom had watched 17-year-old Barry Seal confer with David Ferry when he saw Ferry point to the 50 or so wooden crates staged next to the tarmac. Then on the way back to Baton Rouge, he said that Barry told him that he was making $400 a week flying runs for Ferry and that Ferry was CIA. The crates were weapons and ordnance, according to Seal. "How'd you like to make that kind of money?" Seal asked Odom, whose brother is author Richmond Odom. "Our dad only made about $400 a month back then, and we weren't poor." John Odom, according to his brother Richmond, was stunned and didn't know how to respond. Finally, he told Barry, "I'll think about it." They never discussed it again. Later, we spoke to a doctor, a medical doctor, but still a man of science, which means he had a software program on his personal computer, which translates dollar amounts from any year into current dollars. And we sat in silence when it did the math for us. And while it recalculated it again, because neither of us could believe the number flickering on his laptop screen, David Ferry had been paying young Barry Seal back in 1957 the equivalent of $2,500 per week. And so this, I'll move forward. Well, there, while America basked in the dawn of a golden age of aviation with American planes ruling the skies as British ships had once ruled the oceans, cadet pilot Barry Seal will meet fellow cadet Lee Harvey Oswald, and there both will fall into the orbit of freakish David Ferry. At the tender age of 16, in the flush of optimism that characterized American life in the 1950s, Barry Seal put on a military-style uniform that marked him somehow as one of the chosen, one of the elite. And the overriding question posed by his extraordinary life and death was he not, in some fashion, still wearing that uniform when he died? Something strange went on in the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol of the middle 1950s, something which will lead us onward, a trail of breadcrumbs, if you will, through the signal events of America's secret history in the second half of the 20th century, from the Bay of Pigs to the Kennedy assassination to Watergate and then to Mena, Arkansas. Barry Seal, we will discover, was a contemporary of Lee Harvey Oswald's in the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol, where both young men came under the tutelage of CIA pilot David Ferry, who was himself murdered. We will hear from cops working surveillance on Ferry when he died, the night before he was to be called to testify before Jim Garrison's grand jury probe of the Kennedy assassination. While still an impressionable teenager, Barry Seal came under the tutelage of a man you wouldn't want your worst enemy's kid to know, David Ferry, a pedophile and worse. So that's kind of the introductory elements, but I'm going to kind of skip forward and go to the kind of the next chapter, Learning to Fly, the Civil Air Patrol Way. In 1955, Barry Seal joined the local Baton Rouge Civil Air Patrol and learned to fly along with another kid from the neighborhood, John Odom. And Odom remembers a joint training mission in their unit held with David Ferry's New Orleans CAP unit. "We boys from Baton Rouge weren't nearly as sophisticated as the New Orleans unit, so Barry was much enamored of David Ferry, whose unit was a quasi-military outfit," said Odom. "They met at least three times a week, two evenings in each Saturday, and Lee Harvey Oswald was a member of Ferry's elite little boys club. Both Barry and I met Oswald, who is what I would call a CAP super geek. All of Ferry's CAP guys were geeks, but Oswald epitomized the unit. He was extremely bright, though, and spoke Spanish and some Russian. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations tried to find Oswald and David Ferry's records in the Civil Air Patrol files, they discovered that most of the records of the squadron had been stolen in late 1960. As we will see, something about people like David Ferry and Barry Seal requires government records about them to be misplaced with uncanny frequency. One record, which had escaped being stolen, reveals that Oswald joined the Civil Air Patrol on July 27, 1955, at the same time he was at a summer camp with David Ferry and Barry Seal. By the time the Select Committee had wrapped its investigation, just a reminder, like a lot of those records that I was reading about David Ferry were from the House Select Committee, right? So just a memory. And you can go back and listen to those three. And I just did another interview with James Day about his documentary on David Ferry. So there's a lot of elements to Ferry. This is one of them. Different than kind of what I looked into. By the time the select committee had wrapped its investigation, half a dozen former cadets could be found who were in the Civil Air Patrol in 1955 and could link David Ferry to Lee Oswald. Even the New Orleans Police Department knew it. One vice detective, more about him later, had reported, quote, Ferry assumed control at Moisant Airport at about the same time Oswald joined, unquote. David Ferry's methods of recruitment are no great mystery. After you've met and interviewed a number of former cadets, he looked for bright kids from troubled homes. Seal's father, for example, was alcoholic and belonged to the Ku Klux Klan as well, a fact which several Southern law enforcement authorities stated was often indicative of abuse in the home. A childhood friends of the young Barry Seal, John Prevost, confirmed the outlines of the story. Quote, I lived on the street behind Barry, unquote, said Prevost. He was 1 year behind me in school. He didn't get along with his folks that well. They wanted him to stay in his yard, and I would always hear them calling to him to come home, Barry, Barry. Later, after he'd become a CA pilot himself, Barry Seal would recruit young boys to work for him in the same manner in which he himself had been recruited by Ferry. Charlie Montgomery, today a boyish 43-year-old flight controller in Houston, was a bright youth from a troubled home who went to work for Barry Seal at the tender age of 14. Barry had a helicopter sitting in a trailer in front of his house. That was a tremendous inducement for a young kid looking for a little excitement. My father was an architect and a bit of a drunk. Working with Barry was my haven, says Montgomery. I was a minor who could disappear for a week at a time without my parents asking any questions. Barry had something he would say all the time. Are you ready for adventure? I was. Was it David Ferry who got an impressionable young pilot named Barry Seal into flying drugs for fun and profit? Seal's friend John Prevost stated that while serving jury duty in Louisiana on a drug case, he had encountered David Ferry act in some manner for the defense. David Ferry came to Baton Rouge. He had something to do with the defendant, a black guy, on trial for distributing drugs. That's all I recall, but I knew it was him. Ferry is someone you remember. This was our first indication that we should look closely for evidence indicating the young SEAL's recruiter might have been connected to the same narco underworld inhabited by mob guys like Jack Ruby. Who was David Ferry? Into what sort of enterprise did he induct both Barry Seal and Lee Oswald? If we hope to understand the organization to which Barry Seal devoted his entire business career, we would first need to learn what is known about Ferry. And David Ferry's story, we were to learn, leads to the heart of the spooky netherworld of American covert intelligence, narcotics, Cubans in the mob. It is without question the darkest sub-basement of the secret history of our life and times, the place where many of the biggest American tragedies of the past four decades were set in motion. Hopsicker is a good writer. He understands a lot. It's really good. Sorry for the commentary. For over 30 years, the uncomfortable fact that Lee Harvey Oswald had come under the influence of David Ferry while a member of the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol has been a source of embarrassment and consternation to the peddlers of the official story featuring a crazed lone gunman in the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Officials flatly denied it until photographs of Ferry standing beside Oswald were finally unearthed, taken from the July 55 Civil Air Patrol summer camp at Barksdale Air Force Base. The young Barry Seal is on his way to the poignant picture we had seen. So that's the picture I just mentioned at the intro. So Ferry and Oswald were acquainted. What we found, to our delight, is that instead of further muddying the waters, adding Seal's name to this already heady mix brings some light and clarity to this critical place and time where so much of this country's recent history was set in motion. Stated simply, Seal's recruitment by Ferry just adds to the growing evidence that recruitment was one of Ferry's primary jobs in the Civil Air Patrol, which was itself, we were to learn, a byproduct of the most dark and awful days of the Cold War. Far more than other, and that's my suggestion, like I suggested that in my show with James Day, is this like a Gladio-type organization? And Hopsicker seems to confirm that. Far more than other youth organizations like the Boy Scouts, America's Civil Air Patrol has always been a quasi-military entity. It was to become fertile ground for recruiting hotshot daredevil pilots into this country's then-forming paramilitary forces. Created 1 week before Pearl Harbor propelled the United States into World War II, CAP's role was to harness the nation's aviation's resources to aid in the event America entered the conflict. The American military immediately supported the effort, and Civil Air Patrol members became the Minutemen of World War II, volunteering time, resources, and talents to fill the gaps as men and resources were mobilized to fight abroad. The War Department placed the organization under the jurisdiction of the Army Air Forces. Congress later established the CAP as the auxiliary of the new U.S. Air Force, giving the Secretary of the Air Force authority to provide financial and material assistance to the organization. This explains why it was a U.S. Air Force plane that ferried the 16-year-old Barry Seal to Civil Air Patrol summer camp at Barksdale Air Force Base in 1955. Within days of President Kennedy's assassination, Oswald's involvement with the CAP in New Orleans had become the subject of intense speculation and investigation, and David Ferry, widely regarded as one of the most mysterious people to figure in the investigation of the assassination, briefly was under suspicion by the New Orleans District Attorney's Office. The FBI and Secret Service had then taken over from the local authorities and released Ferry with an apology. Despite the efforts of the FBI, it is today well established that Oswald was part of David Ferry's circle during the period when Ferry was a private investigator and pilot in New Orleans. During the week following the president's murder, the FBI made a perfunctory inquiry into Oswald's membership in the Civil Air Patrol in New Orleans. They discovered that Oswald had joined the patrol as a cadet in 1955, and that David Ferry, an airman of skill and renown, was at that time a leading light of the local patrol unit. The same man called in because of suspicions he may have had something to do with Kennedy's assassination, right? Martin kind of ratted him out less than 48 hours after it happened. Yet they did nothing. Yeah, Garrison confirms that. How the FBI dealt with this inconvenient knowledge illustrates a seemingly deliberate obstruction of justice by the Bureau, evidence for which we were to experience firsthand when, while a retired FBI gumshoe did some investigative work for us, he returned excellent results on everything we asked him to do, except to ascertain for us, if he could, whether Barry Seal had been in the CAP as a youth. Coincidence? Perhaps. But we heard the same pattern of cover-up recounted in book after book about the Kennedy assassination, in which we ratted off example after example of how the Bureau was used 3 decades ago to thwart any real investigation into Kennedy's murder. It is just like the Kenneth Starr probe, which ended any real investigation of drug smuggling through Arkansas. La Place Cachan. On the Kennedy thing, Hoover said to his agents, "Everything gets bagged and tagged and then sent to me directly," former New Orleans CA operative Gordon Novel told us. "If you wanted to keep your job in the Bureau, you bagged it and tagged it and sent it to Hoover, who promptly shit-canned everything." Gordon Novel, today a wizened imp with still bright blue eyes behind bottleneck glasses, has figured around the fringes of American scandals from the Bay of Pigs to JFK's murder to Watergate to the Waco tragedy. He is one of the most colorful characters in New Orleans DA. Jim Garrison's ill-fated 1967 probe was eventually suspected of being one of the second Oswalds and has even been accused of having been present in Dealey Plaza when JFK was hit, a charge Novel vehemently denies. But there's something else about David Ferry which makes the FBI's treatment of him look especially sinister. David Ferry was one of their own. As we will see in the next chapter, Ferry himself was recruited into America's clandestine services way back in 1942 and spent World War II working undercover in South America. At that time, the only place outside the U.S. where the FBI ran all covert intelligence activities. I saw David Ferry's name on a list of disowned agents FBI agent Delbert Hahn admitted to us grudgingly when we told him we had discovered Ferry's Bureau connection. After the assassination, Ferry had been almost immediately fingered as a suspect, we learned to our amazement, by a Jack Martin of New Orleans, who said he thought he recalled seeing a photograph of Oswald with other one-time CAP members in Ferry's home. Ferry claimed to remember nothing but denied ever having any relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald. But he's lied about so much else, too, about other important and easy verifiable things like his knowledge of Cuban Revolutionary Council operations out of Camp Street, for example. Lying is what spooks do. So his denials should have been viewed with some suspicion by investigators, but there weren't any real investigators, it turns out, looking into David Ferry in 1963. Instead, that task fell to the FBI. They immediately muscled the locals who had developed the lead, like New Orleans DA Jim Garrison, aside. Garrison had called Ferry in for questioning about Ferry's now famous trek by car through a blinding rainstorm from New Orleans to Texas the day of Kennedy's murder to go ice skating. Thanks to the FBI, its true purpose even today remains unknown. In an interview with FBI agents in New Orleans on November 25th, 1963, Ferry denied any contact with Oswald in the CAP, saying he had served as a commandant of the CAP from 1953 to 1955, and that his unit had met at New Orleans Lakefront Airport. When his CAP cadets were instructed in the use of rifles, he had not participated in that training, Ferry maintained. The FBI and Secret Service investigation came to a quick conclusion a few short days after the allegation was first reported. A Secret Service report concluded that information furnished by Jack S. Martin to the effect that David William Ferry associated with Lee Harvey Oswald at New Orleans and trained Oswald in the use of a rifle was without foundation. It stated further that Jack S. Martin, who has the appearance of being an alcoholic, has the reputation of furnishing incorrect information to law enforcement officers and attorneys. Right, this is in the HSCA documents. So that's pretty interesting. But yeah, I mean, he's got a lot of stuff. So although the FBI had questioned former CAP members as to whether Oswald had known Ferry in the Civil Air Patrol, an uncomfortable number had answered yes back in 1963, when the truth might still have mattered. That was pretty much that. Moreover, it appears as if this inconvenient knowledge on the part of some of the hapless former cadets was clearly dealt with severely by somebody. As when one of Oswald's former schoolmates, Edward Vobel, first stated that he and Oswald had been in the patrol with Captain David Ferry, and then quite suddenly could no longer recall the matter. The FBI was indifferent to the fact that Vobel had stated he had been scared by crank-type telephone calls and a visit to his home by a strange man. Nor was the Bureau stung into action when another former cadet said Ferry had scurried around just after the assassination, asking whether any old group of photographs of his, Ferry's squadron, featured Oswald. So he was covering it up. According to Lee's own statement, 1954 was the year when he first became interested in communism, stated Robert Oswald. I can't help wondering whether it might have been Ferry who introduced Lee to communist ideas. I realize that I have nothing solid on which to base such a speculation except the timing. Robert Oswald was very likely suspicious with good cause. Lee was a notoriously poor speller, sincerely and because wrote in flawless prose to the Young People's Socialist League. Dear sir, and he's like bad writing. If Oswald received help from David Ferry composing this well-written note, it would fit since Ferry's boss, CIA, ONI, FBI, big shot, Guy Bannister, for whom Barry Seal II, we will hear, worked in the early 60s. Wow, so Seal worked for Bannister too. Ran a New Orleans office devoted to collecting material about communist fronts. Jerry Milton Brooks had told the FBI that at Guy Bannister's insistence, he too had written to Communist Party headquarters in 1961 to inquire about membership and had subscribed to communist publications, odd for someone also a member with Bannister, it said, of the racist right-wing Minutemen. We turned up a half a dozen former Ferry protégés from the Civil Air Patrol, who are today just ordinary citizens like Colin Hamer, a research librarian in the New Orleans Public Library, a pleasant, soft-spoken man who told the House Select Committee, HSCA, of meetings Oswald and David Ferry had attended in an Eastern Airlines hangar at Moisant Airport. Oswald had attended more than a dozen such gatherings while Ferry was a unit leader. I can clearly recall that Ferry headed the Civil Air Patrol unit during the period that Oswald attended. They were both there. Hamer told us the story of why Ferry had moved his capped unit from the small lakefront airport to New Orleans International Airport, or Moisant. Our CAP unit was all boy, just the way Ferry liked it, smiled Hamer. Then a woman named Gladys Durr brought her Girl Scout troop over to join our unit en masse, and we were all sort of paired off, boys and girls together, understand? Ferry didn't like that one little bit, and he and Durr got into a hot clash, and after that he moved to the other New Orleans unit. That was where he started the Falcon Squadron, right? Confirmed Colonel Mary Berkowitz, a Louisiana state official who's been active in that state's CAP since 1959. The Falcon Squadron, we had heard, was an elite unit of Ferry disciples, which included an even more elite inner circle called the Omnipotents. Eager, even after all this time, to distance the CAP from Ferry in every way possible, Berkowitz added, but he didn't have a legal CAP charter for that, right? So he didn't have a legal CAP charter. The momentous clash between David Ferry and the Girl Scouts in 1955 was contemporaneously chronicled by the FBI. They looked into the mess after receiving disturbing news. Miss Ruby Nichols advised the FBI on September 26 1955 that she was not the source of the information to the effect that Ferry had stated he could see no reason to salute the flag, reads an FBI report. She stated Ferry had addressed a scout meeting under the direction of Mrs. R.J. Durr, and that Miss Durr reported information to the effect that Ferry might be a communist. Miss Nichols said she is a member of the seniors of Moissant's squadron of the Civil Air Patrol and is in charge of the Girl Scout squadron. That David Ferry might be, of all things, a communist was an idea quickly dispelled. Joseph Lisman, an agent of Delta Airlines and a commander of the cadets of the Moissant squadron of the Civil Air Patrol, described Ferry to the FBI as being brilliant, but not a genius, as a person who goes off on tangents just short of becoming berserk. He added, David Ferry is a good organizer. He made the Civil Air Patrol at New Orleans Airport what it is today. He has a large following among the Civil Air Patrol cadets and is an excellent flying instructor. He gives 6 hours of his time each week to instructing Moissant Squadron cadets and considerably more of his time associating with them. Lisman said, according to the FBI report, Ferry is a woman hater and that he himself personally disliked Ferry because of his personality traits. For her part, Miss Durr told the FBI she was sorry that the matter had gone as far as it had and said she could think of no disloyal statements made by Ferry. So there's just that so-called eccentric weirdo David Ferry had enough clout to wrangle appointments to the Air Force Academy. Came as news to us. It would have been news to the Warren Commission, too, had they only been interested. Yeah, I guess the Warren Commission doesn't even acknowledge Ferry, just a huge cover-up. Warren Commission apologists like Gerald Posner have stridently insisted that David Ferry was expelled from the Civil Air Patrol in 1955, and therefore Oswald could not have been in his group. Here, one recalls the accusation leveled against the Clinton administration that their favorite stonewalling tactic was to deny. When Ferry was interviewed by FBI agents after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, he recommended Jerry Paradis as a Civil Air Patrol member who could verify whether Oswald had been in his unit. They finally got around to interviewing him in 1979. No wonder, since he told the HSCA, "I specifically remembered Oswald. I can remember him clearly, and Ferry was heading the unit then. I'm not saying that they may have been together. I'm saying it is a certainty." But by 1979, this statement made no headlines. It would have been 15 years earlier. The tactic of deny, deny, deny had worked once again. So that's some Ferry material. I mean, there's just a lot of Ferry material in this book. It's really something else. But let me see some of the comments, some questions. Hey, Blake, May Brussel, finish strong. John B., this is awesome. yeah, update on Caleb Harris, sure. I mean, I'm going to do an update on the whole smiley face killing thing because there is a kind of murder cycle. It's happening all over the world now. I don't think anybody can really even credibly deny it. So it's a shame. But people who are JFK researchers have to get this book. I highly recommend this book after kind of skimming through it, but especially on Ferry. I mean, it's just like there's a whole chapter on Ferry. There's chapter 4, Who is David Ferry? None of the vast array of mysterious and enigmatic characters surrounding the assassination of President John Kennedy has been consistently described as mysterious or enigmatic as David Ferry. His life is uniformly described as being full of strange activity and puzzling behavior. Cuban exiles christened him the master of intrigue. New Orleans DA Jim Garrison called him one of history's most important individuals. At the time of the Kennedy hit, Ferry was a 45-year-old New Orleans resident, well acquainted with all of the most notorious names linked to the assassination: Lee Oswald, Clay Shaw, Guy Bannister, Jack Ruby, and Carlos Marcello. According to Bannister Lieutenant Joe Newbro, he had many other talents as well. Ferry spoke fluent Italian and Greek. I didn't know that, Newberg told us. He flew to Italy on several occasions, I could recall, on arms deals, I think. Arms dealer, speaks Italian. Ferry's assorted talents and eccentricities included being a hypnotist, medical researcher, amateur psychologist, victim of a strange disease, alopecia, which made his body completely hairless, and senior pilot with Eastern Airlines until he was fired for homosexual activity on the job. I didn't know that. He was also described as a CAA contract, quote, contract pilot, which is only accurate if Babe Ruth was a New York Yankee, quote, contract ball player. Yeah, so he's CIA. Barry Seal will also be tagged with his label. When the CIA gets caught with its hand in the multi-billion cocaine cookie jar, Seal is dismissed as a CIA, quote, contract, unquote, pilot who did the, quote, bad stuff, unquote, on his own time or on the side, or while the real agents were looking the other way. Though the cocaine blizzard, which eventually surrounded him on all sides, must have made finding another way to look at some look somewhat difficult. In addition to both being labeled CAA contract pilots, Seal and Ferry shared similarities too numerous to be a coincidence. This is not really surprising. Both held at different times the same job, Southern Regional Manager, Aircraft Procurement and Deployment. So if they are operating out of the same playbook, the same company manual, maybe we can deduce a few hints on domestic disinfo. We noted with surprise that it was not that difficult to discover new information about the much written about Ferry facts, both important and trivial. He was called Dave, not David, for example, by everyone we interviewed who had known him. A little poking around in New Orleans revealed ample evidence that Ferry spent his lifetime in American clandestine services. Maybe make that contract clandestine services, just to be safe. Since it was Ferry who set a young Barry Seal on his path to spookdom, we wondered how Ferry himself had been recruited. No one had been able to find out. And while dark side recruitment officers don't leave behind a paper trail with mundane details like date of employment application, we were able, with a little digging, to discover when and how Ferry's spook career began. David Ferry was born in Cleveland in 1918 to a family which made their careers in public service. His father was a police officer who rose to the rank of captain, his uncle a battalion chief of the Cleveland Fire Department. Dave was reared a Roman Catholic and attended parochial schools until entering Cleveland St. Mary's Seminary at the age of 20 to prepare for a lifetime of service to the Roman Catholic Church as a priest. However, the irrepressible Ferry was unable to disguise his lust for altar boys long enough to don the purple vestments. He was judged unsuited temperamentally for the role of priest by two separate Catholic seminaries. Ferry then began to learn to fly at his father's suggestion to take his mind off his failures at the seminary, according to the HSCA. The HSCA's investigation states, without even a raised eyebrow, that Ferry had become a pilot in 1942 and then had gone to work for an oil drilling firm, which had jobs in South America. We found this highly curious. Ferry, 23 in 1942, prime draft age in the middle of World War II, at a time when you needed more than a note from your local congressman to evade military duty, and he's a pilot to boot. But instead of being drafted, the HSCA report blandly states he, quote, goes to work for an oil drilling firm with interest in South America, unquote. The oil business has certainly produced more than its share of spooks, oil and intelligence work, seemingly hand in glove. Witness, for example, the two Georges, George Bush and George DeMornschild. Lee Oswald, CIA babysitter in Dallas. Both of them, strangely enough, worked in the oil business in Latin America. Yet no one has questioned David Ferry's utterly transparent cover story before. True. And the biggest question this brings up has nothing to do with David Ferry. It has to do with us. Have we always been such sheep? Our suspicions about David Ferry's entry into American intelligence were confirmed by Ferry's own godson, Morris Brownlee, in an interview about a man he still remembers fondly. Brownlee was one of America's first beatniks, a mystic when even Unitarians were frowned on, and a student of philosophy who recently, in his mid-50s, graduated from college. Back in World War II, the development of South American oil resources was a high-priority item for the Nazis, he told us. Remember, they had no oil of their own. The U.S. had a preemptive strategy of denying them these resources. I heard Dave mention his service with the Jade Oil Corporation. His job was to scout a situation under cover of pursuing sociological studies and then report what he found back to the appropriate authorities in the States. He was a pilot and a good one, and he had the gift of gab as well, which I always assumed he inherited from his dad, who was an Irish cop and attorney, Brownlee continued. A former NSA agent who lived and worked in Central America since 1964 told us unequivocally Ferry worked undercover for CIA Front Southern Air Transport, which was just air transport back then. That company housed a lot of weird shit. So what have we got here? Dave Ferry under suspicion of involvement in the assassination less than 48 hours after it occurred, a mentor to Lee Harvey Oswald in the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol and a CIA pilot. In Ferry's life, his path was greased by the same forces which would later smooth the way for Barry Seal. For example, while many have the uncomfortable feeling that their government seems only too willing to track them to hell and back over 20-year-old traffic fines, those fortunate enough to be connected, like Ferry and Barry Seal, have the most enviable dumb luck in their dealings with the government. Ferry, for example, got himself involved in a series of serious misconduct incidents at the Cleveland Air Patrol in 1948, charges which eventually drove him from Ohio. He appropriated a squadron airplane, which had been grounded by the U.S. Air Force, and flew after dark without landing lights from Columbus to Cleveland, identifying himself as a lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force. But when the Cleveland cap commander tried to have Ferry dismissed, the paperwork was somehow lost. So Ferry was still on the books and in good standing 2 years later when two Ohio cap cadets reported that their instructor Ferry had taken them to a house of prostitution in a nearby town. While he was not charged with a crime, his dismissal from the Cleveland cap became imminent. That's when enterprising Dave transferred himself to a post in the Louisiana cap. Ferry had become persona non grata with the Cleveland cap after being accused of sexually corrupting young men in his charge. But when the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol requested his records from Ohio, these papers too had somehow been lost. Predictably, the Civil Air Patrol has never been able to satisfactorily account for either of these inexplicable lapses. Nor, for that matter, can they explain to this day how their records of Ferry and Oswald happened to be stolen after Kennedy's assassination. So tracking Barry Seal's recruiter, Dave Ferry, has already paid off. We've just learned a lesson, quote, being connected means never having to say you're sorry because your paperwork gets lost so often, unquote. Another telltale sign of Ferry's covert connections occurred when, while just a lowly rookie pilot at Eastern, he was nonetheless already known and admired by none other than Eastern President's General Eddie Rickenbacker. Rickenbacker, no slouch himself in the spook department, somehow found it necessary to have placed in the file of the seemingly inconsequential junior employee David Ferry a glowing letter of recommendation. Quote, this man's efforts bear watching and his qualifications justify his being used and helped whenever possible in line of duty and even beyond, quote, unquote, Rickenbacker wrote. Much later, Barry Seal, by all accounts an outstanding young pilot, becomes the first youngest 707 captain, and then later the youngest captain of a 747 while at Howard Hughes's TWA. And in all fairness, it must be asked whether ability alone led to these early accolades, or was it also a Dan Quayle-like case of, it's not what you know, but who, unquote. In a small final irony, 30 years after Ferry and Rickenbacker's paths cross, and 20 years after Barry Seal is recruited by Dave Ferry, Barry Seal's C-123 was specially outfitted by the CIA for its mission into Sandinista, Nicaragua at Rickenbacker Air Force Base, small world. As we begin to delve into the life of David Ferry, clues to his checkered career as a spook were visible all around, but some came from sources considered less sporting than others, his fellow spooks. Former aide to the deputy director of the CIA, Victor Marchetti, was told by a CIA colleague that, quote, Ferry had been a contract agent to the agency since the early 60s and had been involved in some of the Cuban activity. Marchetti was convinced that Ferry was a CIA contract officer and involved in various criminal activities, telling author Anthony Summers that he observed consternation on the part of when CIA Director Richard Helms and other senior officials when Ferry's name was first publicly linked with the assassination in 1967. But because the boys in trench coats exude such a smug George W. Bush-like actually sense of their own superior intelligence, it is far more fun, as well as more sporting, to find civilian witnesses. We found Eddie Shearer, one of Ferry's cadet disciples in the late 1950s and early 60s, who had much to say about Dave Ferry. For example, Shearer spent time in the gas station which Carlos Martello gave Ferry right after the Kennedy assassination. Many writers, no doubt afflicted with overactive imaginations, believe the station was a payoff for Ferry's role in the hit. Quote, there's never been any doubt in my mind that Dave's gas station, a Gulf station out on Airline Highway, was a CIA cover, unquote, he told us. Some people I know pretty well hung out there, And it was the funniest thing. If you drove in to fill up with gasoline, which is what a gas station is supposed to be for, right? You could sit in your car forever waiting for someone to come out and tell you they were closed or something. Whatever they were doing there, pumping gas wasn't it. Much maligned New Orleans DA Jim Garrison apparently noticed the same thing. Quote, although Ferry, in all intents and purposes, was unemployed at the time, he said in Heritage of Stone, an examination of his bank account revealed that during the three-week period prior to the president's assassination, he deposited $7,093. Then a few months after the assassination, Ferry suddenly acquired a large service station. He apparently ran it much in the same way he maintained his apartment. On one occasion, he had just filled the gas tank with an acquaintance and waved him away, turning down payment for the gas. Forget it, he said. The government's paying for it anyway. Barry Seal, like David Ferry, will also own a gas station among a dozen small businesses in the 60s and 70s. One of the most revealing insights we received about Seal came from someone from military intelligence who had known him in the 60s. We had spent several weeks looking through boxes of business receipts from Seal's various enterprises before we asked this man for an explanation of some of the nuances of covert operations. Is an agent like Seal primarily a small business owner and suburban father? Someone who gets a call to do something for the boys one or two days a month, we asked him. That's not how it works, explained this intel veteran, smiling at our naivete. Cover was very important in the 60s and 70s. In the 80s, things got sloppy and it became less important. But back when you're talking about your cover was very important. So we asked incredulously, still distracted with thoughts of Seal's and Ferry's contract pilot status. Do you mean Seal was a full-time CIA guy whose various businesses were just cover? His answer was matter of fact, yes. And so it was with David Ferry, who, in addition to his pilot duties, also conducted wide-ranging and bizarre experiments. At the exact same time, the CIA has admitted doing freaky CIA mind control MKUltra research. Out back of Ferry's house, he had a workshop in his backyard, Ed Shearer told us. And I know this sounds weird, but he had a skull out there, hooked up to a skeleton, and to simulate the nervous system, he had used different colored electrical wire, blue, red, green, in an effort to understand human physiology. Dave was a brilliant individual interested in all kinds of things, continued Shearer, who related how Ferry's mother, whom he knew from visiting Ferry, had told him that Dave's brother was a nuclear physicist. When we tracked down Ferry's brother, the nuclear physicist living in California, he was unwilling to talk. Nuclear physicists are notoriously smart. There are almost constant examples of David Ferry's brilliance when you hung around with him, said Shearer. He had a little lawnmower, just to give you for one instance, that he couldn't get to start. So I was out back one day, repeatedly pulling the little rope to get it started while he watched. What a waste of efficiency, Dave mused out loud. If we could only get rotary motion from a motor at the start. Remember, this was years before the rotary engine was patented, before anyone had even heard of a Wankel motor. But Dave had the same idea, just talking out loud. Like many in New Orleans, Shearer was accustomed to seeing Ferry at the airport in the company of Sergio Arcacha Smith, the Cuban revolutionary front leader for whom Ferry was training exile pilots. There were a lot of things about Dave that just didn't fit unless you added them up another way, he says today. Just his appearance, good God. You have to wonder how Eastern was able to keep him as long as they did. I remember him taxiing his Eastern Convair at one time on his weekday Houston to Orleans milk run. He would always pull in way faster than any other airline pilots did, and he'd be leaning out of one side of his cockpit window, looking like some damn railroad engineer or something. Then two weekends every month, Dave flew a Constellation up to Washington, D.C. and back. And while he was up there, he was meeting with his CIA contacts. It would make sense. And if while he was up there, he was meeting with the CIA contacts, it would make sense. Because I was with him on three or four occasions when he returned. And when he opened his wallet, I noticed he had several $100 bills. That doesn't seem extraordinary, we replied. He was a pilot at Eastern, and don't they make decent money? You got to remember, this was in the 50s, Shearer stated. Anyone who was working back then can tell you, you got paid in 20s. Nobody got paid in $100 bills back then. You hardly ever saw $100 bills. Shearer got conclusive proof of David Ferry's career in clandestine services less than 5 years after Ferry's death. In 1972, I was asked to join the Senior Civil Air Patrol, an outfit with no cadets, Shearer relates. There, I met Herb Wagner, a Navy flyer in World War II, who had then been recruited by the OSS, the CIA's precursor at the end of the war. When we got friendly, I'd go over to his house, and sometimes he would reminisce about things he had done for the CIA back in the middle 50s. Herb told me, once you're in the CIA, it's hard to get out. He tried to get out when he got married and settled down. He and his wife had adopted a baby daughter, and he wasn't the daredevil he had once been, but they still pressured him to fly. Said Shearer, I visited him one time after he'd gotten a visit from the CIA to go do something he no longer really wanted to be doing, quite obviously, because he was really down when I talked with him. And that was when he loosened up and told me about Dave Ferry saying that, quote, if the truth was ever known about Dave Ferry, he would be recognized as one of the true unsung heroes of the United States, unquote. And this was coming from a man who did not hand out praise easily. And that's when I realized that Ferry had been a regular CIA guy, not just some asset or contract operative. Confirmation of Ferry's status often came in casual conversation with pilots who had worked in New Orleans. I first met Dave Ferry out of Lakefront Airport in 1965, pilot James Posh told us. He was running a fixed-base operation with five DC-3s and some PBYs. That is quite a little fleet of planes Ferry was handling out of the CIA's fixed-base operations in New Orleans. By 1972, 5 years after Ferry had been suicided, his protege SEAL will be using, according to transcripts of SEAL's 1972 trial for exporting, munitions, the same fleet of DC-3s and PBYs which David Ferry had controlled. So SEAL literally took over David Ferry's operation. That's striking. Just how much can a CIA agent get away with in America? Would you believe child molestation? David Ferry was arrested in New Orleans on August 8, 1961 for contributing to the delinquency of a juvenile and rearrested 3 days later for extortion, engaging in homosexual behavior with a 15-year-old boy, and indecent behavior with three others. The extortion charge reported the New Orleans Times-Picayune on August 29, 1961, was related to a 16-year-old who had made statements to police that Ferry showed up at the grocery store where he worked, threatening the youth into signing papers, stating he would not press the crime of nature charge in the case. What has never been told is what happened after Dave Ferry was arrested to the cops who executed the warrant. When authorities with the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office entered Ferry's home with a search warrant on August 22, 1961, they found munitions, maps of the Cuban Coast rifles, rifles, ammunition, and two miniature submarines later used to infiltrate CIA operatives into Cuba. An FBI report a year later stated that the Cuban Revolutionary Council, of which Ferry was co-founder and leader, gave one Jose Rebel a highly sophisticated assassination weapon and sent him into Cuba via a CIA-supplied submarine. Anyone busted on a morals charge should be as lucky as Ferry was. He had an OJ-like dream team defense, consisting of such legal luminaries as Kennedy assassination suspect and FBI CIA O&I made guy Guy Bannister and his attorney G. Ray Gill, who spent most days toiling as Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello's main attorney. Guy Bannister will come up again later in 1972 in connection with Barry Seal's munitions trial. On trial with Seal was New York mobster Murray Kessler, who authorities assumed had met Seal when both worked for Bannister in the early 60s. We interviewed the police officers who executed the search warrant and arrested Dave Ferry on morals charges back in 1961, and discovered that no one until now had talked to them about what both considered the most bizarre experience of their law enforcement career. When Ferry was arrested, according to both of their accounts, all hell broke loose. Former Sergeant Ronald Fournier of the New Orleans PD shakes his head in disbelief today at what transpired. Quote, it started out as a regular arrest. We were receiving complaints from parents that Ferry was taking good kids and corrupting them, getting them to break into the gun rooms of high schools and steal guns because he was into gun running to the Cubans. We also had complaints that he would sit with the kids, sit around in a room and masturbate in a circle jerk, I guess you would call it, stated Fournier. Ferry was a great imposter, he continued. He could be just about anything he needed to be under the circumstances, like treating the kids medically as if he were a doctor, which he did. He had a card identifying himself as a doctor which is kind of funny since he looked like he had moss from a tree glued to his scalp. So we raided his house. We knew he was carrying on sexually with the children, but good Lord, what we found. We found maps, guns, high school official Air Force recruiting films, books on the occult and hypnotism lying around, and chalices and other instruments used in mass. So there's the kind of validation of the weekly black masses that Gus Russo talked about. And then the next day, to our shock, Fournier continued, we discovered that warrants had been issued for our arrest, my partner and myself, the cops who had executed the search warrant. Ferry had gone to a judge and gotten warrants issued. Nothing like it had ever happened before. And that's when it all began to be a little bit intimidating, frankly. Charles Jono, Fournier's partner in the New Orleans Police Department, search of Ferry's premises in 1961, agreed with this account and offered something else. I handled surveillance on Ferry for Garrison later. He told us, Garrison was on this guy like rice on gravy. I'd watch Ferry pacing around his apartment nude, smoking one cigarette after another. That's what he'd do, pace and smoke. It was strange to watch a guy do that. Ferry would talk to you like he was a friend of yours, but I was never fooled. I know he'd stab you in the back as easy as look at you. After Ferry's arrest, a bizarre series of negotiations began regarding the charges against him. We were trying to get these runaway kids away from him and return them to their parents, and we began to get phone calls setting up meetings held under mysterious circumstances with Cubans and cockies who said they would produce the kids if and only if Ferry was not prosecuted, said Fournier. The story of almost state-to-state negotiations is too similar to be mere coincidence to the incredible offer which the Louisiana State Police will make to Barry Seal 20 years later in 1981, when they implore him to move his drug smuggling operation out of their state, and in return they will cease efforts to indict him for crimes he had already committed. So that's basically it. I think I'll stop there. That'll be the first hour. So I'll follow up reading this. I'm also going to read from another book. But thanks a lot for listening. And you can listen to the whole catalog of my material on my podcast, William Ramsey Investigates. And I think I'm very close to 1,200 episodes. But yeah, thank you for listening.